Okay, I mentioned before the problems that we confront in chapter 2, but let me repeat them here. Chapter 1 is about determining whether the defendant did, in effect, something wrong. Chapter 3 is about determining whether and to what extent the plaintiff suffered damages. Chapter 2 is the connecting link, the link approximate cause. A defendant can only be held liable for injury suffered by the plaintiff if the defendant's breach of duty, commonly negligence, but maybe strict liability, where that caused the plaintiff's injuries. Now, as I said before, sometimes proximate cause is a no-brainer. If the defendant saw a yellow light in time to stop, but decided to try to gun the engine and get through the intersection, and by the time he gets to the intersection, the plaintiff's pulled out, thinking the light was green and it was safe to proceed, and gets smacked by the defendant, we have to determine in Chapter 1, did the defendant act negligently? What color was the light? You know, would a reasonable person stop? Did he have an excuse? Blah, 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 blah. Having done that, though, if we conclude, no, the defendant was not right, the defendant should have stopped, the defendant negligently chose to proceed through the intersection, it's not a difficult question to say, well, gee, I wonder if that actually caused the injury. Well, of course, duh. If he'd stopped, we'd have no injury. By contrast, the cases we tend to look at in Chapter 2 are ones which are far from no-brainers. They're difficult for one of two reasons, because of the two elements of proximate cause. The first being the element of showing, the expression we wind up using is, it is a but-for cause. This is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. Now, sometimes that's just a factually difficult question. I don't know whether this would have made a difference or not, whether using reasonable care would have prevented this injury. In other cases, we have more of a policy-oriented question. Well, maybe it didn't actually meet that test, but there's some reason we want to use a slightly different test. So there are a lot of those kinds of problems in the first half of Chapter 2. The second half of Chapter 2 deals with questions that are not so much this question about a but-for cause relationship. Did this or did this not have a relationship such that we can say without this defendant's action, the plaintiff would have avoided the injury? That's not the issue in the second half. The second half is, okay, maybe it was a but-for cause, but can we say, in addition to that, that the law should properly blame the defendant for the plaintiff's action or for the plaintiff's injury? Not so much did the defendant do wrong, but are there other policy considerations at play? Suppose, for example, the defendant negligently fails to provide light in the parking lot adjacent to the defendant's motel, and one of the motel's customers is going out in the early morning before the sun has come up to get into their car to drive away, and while they're in this dark parking lot, they get assaulted by somebody. Maybe there's a statute or some regulation or industry custom that says you're supposed to have a lighted parking lot. Defendant didn't have one. If the thing had been properly lit, the plaintiff could have avoided the injury. But we may have difficulty as a legal matter saying the motel owner should pay for the plaintiff's injury, because we would say, well, wait a minute. The motel didn't hit this person over the head and steal their money. Some, you know, mugger did. Does the law want to blame motels for injuries caused by muggers? That is not a factual, scientific type question. It's a policy question. So we refer to the second half of Chapter 2 under the heading of legal cause. Legal in the sense that the law has chosen to make this an occasion for compensation, or has chosen not to. And as we'll, you know, we'll go into much more detail about the nature of that later on. So that's just kind of a brief overview of where we're going in Chapter 2. I want to start with this case, Mitchell versus Gonzalez. It's 12 years old now. When I first threw this in there, it was hot off the press. But it's still a fairly good vehicle for us to review exactly what we're doing or not doing when we use these terms of proximate cause. Too bad I already squandered my ability to call Mr. Mitchell over there, otherwise his namesake here to be in the list. Ms. Cook, have you done one of these? You have? I see how senile I am. Mr. Everett, have you done one of these?
No.
Please, why don't you tell us about Mitchell versus Gonzalez?
All right. Kind of a short version of the facts are the plans of the parents of this 12-year-old child, Demetria. He couldn't swim, and he was playing out in the lake with his children, Louis and Yoshi. They're playing on a paddleboard and out in water over their head, and as a result of some rough housing, the paddleboard tipped over and Meechie drowned. And kind of pretending that the whole family was negligent, parents were watching the children close enough, and the children could have been rough housing, and they should have been more prompt.
Okay, so on a variety of different grounds, the plaintiff presents the case that the parents were negligent. And the case gets submitted to the jury, and the jury returns a verdict that is actually not simply we find for the plaintiff, we find for the defendant. Many times it's to one or the other party's advantage, oftentimes to the defendant's advantage, to require the jury to answer what's called a jury interrogatory or juror interrogatory, where you specify, and I've got a sample of this attached in the appendix after it gives you the jury instructions. It shows you a typical kind of juror interrogatory where you go through these in a sequential fashion. And that's what the jury did here. The jury was asked first whether they found the defendants to be negligent. What was their answer to that question? They were. But the next question was, do you find that this negligence proximately caused the plaintiff's injury? And their answer to that question was? And they're instructed at that point, if you say yes to both of these, you know, answer these subsequent, but if you answer no to either one, thank you very much, your job is concluded. So the jury comes back with this verdict, and the judge says, fine, thank you for your service, blah, 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 we'll all go home now. Plaintiff appeals. What's the basis of the plaintiff's appeal?
That the court instructed the jury.
And what was, first of all, let's hear the instruction given to the jury. What's the instruction given to the jury? And where are you reading from, just so everybody can follow along here? Footnote number 2 here, bottom of page 1, right-hand side, carries over to the next page. This something, I forget what the B in badgie stands for, if someone from California might be. Board or something like board approved jury instructions. I forget exactly what the acronym is. But in any event, these are the boilerplate standard instructions that are used throughout the trial courts of California, or were at the time at least. And as you say, Approximate cause is one which
a natural continuous process produces the injury and without which
yes. Now, notice how that instruction incorporates both parts of the traditional test. What is the first part of that instruction? Actually, it's in reverse order here. Yes, and they don't call it legal cause, but what they say is that it produces it in a natural and continuous sequence. And we'll talk more in the second half of this chapter about all the different variations of that. But then the second half of this jury instruction corresponds to the first half of this chapter, that it is not only one which occurs in a natural or where in a natural and continuous sequence it produced the injury, but it is also a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. That's the but-for cause. Again, it is a cause but for which no injury. Sometimes people call it sine qua non. That's the Latin, that without which. Or they call it cause in fact. Meaning, yeah, as a matter of fact, it caused the injury. All of these, again, are efforts to put some concrete attachment on this philosophical concept. What do we mean by cause? I said before, you know, my friend in college who thought she killed her father because she's playing with him and then he dies. She, you know, how do we know that one thing causes another, or in what sense we mean it caused it? It's a complicated sort of philosophical notion. But again, we want to know the difference between those things which had an impact. Did the lack of light in the parking lot result in the mugger hitting this person over the head, or was the lack of light unrelated to that? As we'll see later on, the lady who falls down the stairs at the train station, what was the relationship between the lack of light and her fall? So oftentimes we want to know the answer to that question. Is this a cause without which the injury would not have occurred? Okay, so that's the instruction that was given to the jury and had been given for years. But the plaintiff says there's something terribly wrong with that. What's wrong with this instruction? What's confusing about it? Okay. What's confusing about the term proximate cause?
I think the majority of people said that they thought that the jury might have thought like closeness and time and space was more important.
Yeah. If the jury fixates on that word, proximate, what does proximate, that's not a term of our ordinary language. We use the word approximate. I've got an approximate time of arrival here. It's more or less somewhere in the ballpark of. But you do use the word proximity. You know, that happened in proximity to something else. That may not be part of everybody's everyday book. It's a fairly sophisticated word, but it's not one you would not recognize. It's in proximity to something else, meaning nearby, next to. Why would that be inappropriate in this case?
They're saying that the jury might have focused on the temporal proximity of the disability.
When were the parents negligent?
Earlier.
Yeah. When they first let Dimitri out of their immediate sight, when they let Dimitri go off with Luis. Now, there's dispute about whether these parents were informed about Dimitri's inability to swim. But assuming the jury found the testimony credible that Dominici, and in any event, whether he could swim or not, even kids who can swim get hit on the head or they get, you know, whatever it is, sending him off with rambunctious Luis without supervision was a bad idea. So, again, but that happens at one point in time. It's much later and much further away geographically. I'm negligent here dealing with Dominici. Dominici then runs off with Luis. They get in trouble later on and farther away and they drown. If the jury thought that the negligence and the injury had to be proximate, negligence here, shortly thereafter, close by injury, well, they might have said, it's not proximate. Okay? So the majority says this term is so confusing that we ought not use it. Moreover, they say, this whole notion of imposing this particular test is wrong. They're going to substitute a different test for establishing proximate cause. What's their new formulation?
Legal cause of injury is caused with substantial effect from bringing it out.
They want to use this substantial factor test as their primary issue in establishing causation. Now, for my money, for what it's worth, I don't think you get much out of this. What is a substantial factor in causing injury? It's a pretty vague, undefined term. Now, it still corresponds to sort of an intuitive judgment that people make. Again, there are different kinds of things, just as my friend in college should not have blamed herself for her father's death. So similarly, other things that people do ought not to be, you know, you shouldn't make a causal relationship between one thing and another. If I, if my wife calls me on her cell phone, hi, I'm on my way home, and I say, could you stop at the grocery store and pick up a gallon of milk, and while she's at the grocery store, a meteor strikes, and they're all wiped out. Well, I'll say, well, I'm never drinking milk again. that was a terribly selfish thing. No, I would say that the relationship between these is pure. That's not. I wouldn't say that my desire for milk is a cause, it was a substantial factor, although, again, as it happens, if I hadn't wanted her to stop for that gallon of milk, she would have been safely home when the meteor struck and wiped all those other people out. But again, intuitively, we sort of filter things in and out, what causes what, and there may be some scientific dispute. What's the relationship between greenhouse gases and global warming? What's the relationship between this and that? What effect does execution have on murder rates? All sorts of interesting theoretical questions about what relationship there is between this thing and that thing, and what scientific studies count in resolving those disputed issues. But at least we have in our mind some sort of filter of what things are properly viewed as a cause of what other things. Again, the California court says, we don't like this term proximate cause. Interestingly, there's nothing in the instruction itself that uses that term except the opening thing. You could call it, you could just change the label. Cause for purposes of tort injury means blah, 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 and you wouldn't have the word proximate anywhere in there. Would jurors still be potentially confused? Oh, you bet they would. There are lots of terms that we give to jurors that they may very well find confusing. But I guess I would argue there's a dissenting opinion here. Let's talk about that for a minute, because obviously I have more sympathy with the dissenting opinion, and I feel justified in sort of pushing that a little bit, because California left the mainstream on this point. Most jurisdictions employ a traditional two-part test. So that's, you know, I expect you to be familiar with this two-part test, and I kind of did you a disservice by starting you off with somebody that rejects it, but it helps to highlight the significance of it. So what's the dissenting opinion here? Right. He's saying precisely because this is a difficult area where people could easily do get confused, we need something, first of all, that's had the test of time. We've been using this two-part test for a long time. Up till now, we thought of it as being relatively helpful. And we've replaced a fairly specific thing with a lot of history and meaning with something vague, like substantial factor, which, you know, may trigger the jury's intuitive judgment, but we're trying to help them get beyond their intuitive judgment to give it kind of body. And Justice Kennard, in his dissent, again, tries to explain the traditional two-part test, that there is a but-for cause analysis. I'm trying to remember how he describes that. Yeah, cause in fact. And then he describes the second part as a normative evaluative consideration. I'm trying to remember where that language is found. Which side of the column?
Left side
of
the social
evaluative process. Yeah. Right, a social evaluative process. I think elsewhere he uses the term normative, I believe. Oh, it's on page 9? Yeah, okay, so page 9, left column, middle, smack in the middle here, just below the hole that's punched there. As I shall explain, proximate cause, an element of physical or logical causation, and a more normative evaluative. Again, when we speak of something being normative, we mean setting a standard about what's sort of right and wrong. And indeed, that's the whole notion of legal causation. Should Kmart be responsible if a drunk customer comes in and Kmart sells this drunk guy a hunting rifle and he goes home and shoots his girlfriend? That's a normative question. You may either believe that it is right that Kmart should be responsible for this danger that they have enhanced by selling hunting rifles, and in effect, if they're going to do it and sell it to irresponsible people, they're going to share in the blame. Or you could say, as a normative function, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people. However you come out on that, it's a normative question about setting standards. It's not a scientific, logical, physical relationship. There is a question about what's, you know, later on we'll look at the case of a convenience store that sells alcohol to somebody who gives it to his friends, who get drunk, who cause an injury to somebody. Who in that chain of distribution of alcohol should be held responsible? Again, a normative question. So it's helpful, I believe, and in agreement with Justice Kennard, to sort of separate these two questions One is this physical, logical connection. If you've been working around hazardous chemicals and you get leukemia, can you fairly blame the hazardous chemicals for the leukemia? That's a physical, logical issue. What do we know about leukemia? What do we know about this chemical? What do we know about the relationship? Not a normative question. Whereas the question about people who sell alcohol, give alcohol away, people get hurt, deciding which, under what circumstances, a person who furnishes alcohol to somebody else is responsible for the injury they cause, that's a normative question. To Gallagher.
So the goal there is to try and bring the reasonable person standard, and the form of the actual injury, and the issues.
Well, there's still an idea, we're all trying to be reasonable here, but whereas Chapter 1, which we remember so well and so fondly, Chapter 1 is about, it, as it were, evaluating the rightness or wrongness of the defendant's conduct. Did the defendant meet or not meet our standard of what a reasonable person would do? We may satisfy ourselves that what the defendant did was wrong. Nonetheless, in Chapter 2, we have a separate question, which is, even if the defendant did something wrong, did it cause this injury? Statute says, if you have a public parking lot with more than 50 spaces, it must be lighted to blah, 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 standards of so many picocuries, I don't know, you know. The defendant didn't meet that standard. As a matter of law, the parking lot didn't live up to that. But if it's the scene of a mugging, well, maybe that's precisely why we require there to be a certain amount of light. But then again, you might say, you know, again, on a normative basis, that you want to go a different direction. Anyway, well, I hope we can remember some of this. Well, we'll pick up with this on Tuesday. Monday we'll be dealing with Chapter 1. Yeah.